Okay, everybody, welcome to a Crash Course in Java, an introduction to object-oriented programming. Today we're going to be covering some basics of writing code in the Java programming language and relating it back to what we've already learned in C to prepare you for working on any final projects you might want to implement in the Java language. So first, let's take a look at the Java language itself. First thing to get out right out the door is that it has absolutely nothing to do with JavaScript. So while some of the things you learned while working with JavaScript will apply here because languages have some similarities, don't mistake the presence of Java in the the prefix for JavaScript as meaning the two languages are related in some way. I believe it was Netscape who was working on JavaScript, and they were sort of just riding on the coattails of the success of the Java programming language in order to attract attention to what they were doing. So anything that you've done in JavaScript does not necessarily apply to Java, and we'll see in a moment how the languages do actually substantially differ in some important ways. So Java was developed in 1995 by Sun Microsystems, which is now part of Oracle Systems. It continues to be one of the most popular languages in use. The syntax is largely derived from C and C++, which is great news for you since you all are familiar with C. So writing code in Java, although it involves some intricacies that you're not familiar with because it's object-oriented, will be familiar to you, and hopefully the transition won't be so painful because you are so used to writing code in C. The main impetus behind Java is to let application developers write code once and then run it anywhere. So there's this strong emphasis on being able to write portable code very easily, and we'll talk about how this works. So first, let's look at the properties of Java as you'll need to interact with it. So the properties of Java which are relevant to your experience programming in it. So Java is a strictly typed language, much like C, but unlike PHP and JavaScript. And what this means is that when you create a data type in Java, it's of a particular type. So if you create some variable x, it's going to be of type int x or boolean x or something like that. And after you initialize that, or after you declare that variable and you try to place a value in it later, it has to be of the same type as you declared the variable to initially be. So in JavaScript and PHP, we have freedom where we can create $x or x and just place a 7 in it and then change that to a string. You could put like the word banana in there later, and the language doesn't really care. It's loosely typed to let you do pretty much wherever you want to do with those variables. Not so in Java. We're reverting to more of an environment like C's, where data types are in fact strictly typed, and after you set a type for a variable, you do have to adhere to that type. Java is also object-oriented, which means you're able to work with these things called objects, which we'll get into more in depth later on. Essentially what this means is you're able to that everything in Java can sort of be treated as these structural entities which contain both methods and fields, which you can think of as being functions or variables. So if you recall structs from C, they were sort of these data structures that you had in the abstract that contained various fields. Objects are sort of like that, except you can also include methods which are in them, so they get their own functions. We'll talk about that more in depth later in the seminar. Okay. Java is also a compiled language, kind of. It's also sort of interpreted. So that seems like a contradiction, because we talked about C and said it was a compiled language, and then we talked about PHP and JavaScript and how they were interpreted languages. So how is it that Java can be somewhere in between? We had treated this as sort of a binary before. Well, Java works in the context of the Java virtual machine. So essentially what happens when you're writing Java code is you write your code up in some .java file, so your source code is placed in your in this text file which you've created with your text editor, and then you compile that by running a compilation command using the program javac, which is sort of the equivalent to our C compiler in the terminal, GCC. And that code is then compiled directly to machine code like C is, that assembly language that processors can understand, instead to Java bytecode. And then this bytecode is run in the Java virtual machine, which in turn runs on your computer. So we sort of get like this recursive element to what's happening. You might be a little reminiscent of the Yodog meme. Yodog, I heard you like cross-platform support, so I put a machine in your machine so you can run on multiple systems. So what's happening here is we're actually simulating this special machine that's able to interpret Java commands, which are compiled from your source code, and then running that on all these different machines using these Java virtual machines, which have been created to run natively on each different type of system. So there's a Java virtual machine for Mac OS, there's a Java virtual machine for Windows 7, there's a Java virtual machine for Ubuntu, and in fact, there's a Java virtual machine for all kinds of devices. According to the claims on Sun's website about Java, Java powers set-top boxes, like cable boxes, printers, webcams, games, car navigation systems, lottery terminals, medical devices, parking payment stations, and more. So all sorts of devices can be programmed such that they have this Java virtual machine, which can take in this Java bytecode, which has been compiled as the result of the source code you wrote. So essentially, we're adding a layer of abstraction, which allows us to run our Java code on any emulator, essentially, for a Java machine that we can implement on all sorts of systems. So as long as we can code a Java virtual machine for some system, you know you're going to be able to run your code on that device. So this leads to the to this sort of problem that we see exemplified by XKCD. So in this webcomic, the character off screen here is distraught because he's noticing that the hardware he's working with actually runs Java code. And he's very surprised, and he expresses the belief that they probably hired someone to spend up to 6 months porting the Java virtual machine onto this very simple hardware just so they could write their 20 lines of code in a familiar setting. And then Black Hat Guy comes in and makes a reference, sort of a, yeah. Much like the analogy that when you all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When all you're used to working with in Java, everything looks like it's a problem that could be solved with Java. So this seems like a negative, but to push back on this idea, the idea of the Java virtual machine actually introduces a lot of power. Obviously here, it's being taken to an absurd extreme where very simple hardware is having this Java virtual machine abstraction built upon it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not worthwhile. And the ability to write code in a familiar setting on any device is actually very powerful when we find situations where where it is important to be able to do that. So anytime a manufacturer introduces a new kind of device and they want people to be able to run applications on it, for example, the Android phones, which have been coming out recently, or possibly even televisions like this one which we're displaying this, I'm not actually sure this can run Java apps, but we're starting to see devices which previously did not run apps which do. You can run Skype on this thing, actually. It's very helpful to be able to create a familiar environment that people can run code on and then be able to expand their programs onto all sorts of different devices. Okay, so what are some of the advantages of Java which we've enumerated? So it's supported across multiple platforms. This is really big. If you know how to write code on Java, you know how to write code to some degree on a lot of different devices, and that's very helpful to you. There's no need to manage memory directly. Java sort of takes away some of the power C offers you to interact with the system at the low level, whereas in C we'd use things like malloc and free to access at the low level individual contiguous regions of memory. We don't really need to do that in Java. You get a region of memory in Java, you use it for a while, the system figures out when you're done using it and gets rid of it. This is called garbage collection. So essentially, Java is abstracting away a lot of your responsibilities and taking it upon itself to solve these problems for you, which is very helpful for you as a programmer because you avoid a lot of headaches and a lot of potential bugs which could result as a result of you not handling your memory appropriately. Java also has an expansive library of useful classes and objects. We'll see how this is helpful very soon when we start actually writing Java code, but essentially there's all sorts of classes which are available to you that you can use to solve problems in Java, which it would be a little more difficult to solve in C because you'd have to hunt down a particular library and then link it in or include the header file somehow. And it's just a bit more of a mess in other languages than it is in Java, where a lot of this just comes for free. The cost of this is that there is a considerable overhead when you have all these extra features that are very handy for the programmer, and there are efficiency costs as a result. So you want to be careful when you're using Java. If you want bleeding-edge performance where your program is running very quickly and you're handling perhaps large amounts of data that you need to process in a very limited, finite amount of time, then Java is probably not the programming language for that situation. But if you're writing something relatively simple, which doesn't really make that intensive use of hardware, maybe a simple game or a simple CS50 project or some little app that runs on a phone or something that just has to make a request to some web server and get information back, then that overhead doesn't really factor in as much as the simplicity of writing code in Java should matter to you.
Overhead?
Oh, I'm sorry. So I'm using this term overhead, and a nice way to think of this actually is if you're thinking of the space of a nice analogy, if you think of the space of memory and resources that's available to you in a program, you can sort of think of the overhead as being like, okay, well, there's a bunch of services and things I need to do for you because you're running this in Java and we need to take care of garbage collection. And we're also including all these libraries. So here's the memory and the resources we had available to us in our computer before, and here's some overhead. Java's doing all this stuff. So I'm using this to represent not just space, but time. So some of the time that's being used by the CPU is being used checking over all the variables you're using and your memory pointers, figuring out what you're using. We're also storing library functions and all sorts of other things somewhere. And you can also sort of imagine how it takes a toll on processing if you have to simulate another machine on your computer and then run code on that machine. So you have to maintain the environment that is composed that makes up the Java virtual machine itself. So when I say overhead, just in summary, I'm essentially saying the amount of resources that you give up inherently because you have to keep track of all this additional information in Java. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
All right, great. Okay. Everyone happy with the overhead explanation, by the way? I didn't want to just, yeah.
And if you have multiple Java applications running on a machine, is it still just that one Java virtual machine that's like running all of them?
That's a really good question. So the question was if you have multiple Java applications running at the same time on one machine, is the same Java virtual machine taking care of all those, or are there different instances of the Java virtual machine running at the same time which are handling all those? Offhand, I actually do not know the answer to that question. I'll talk to me afterward, and we'll do some research on it and do a follow-up, and maybe I'll send that out with an email afterward explaining that. Yeah, that's a very good question. Okay, any other questions at this time before we move forward? Okay. Let's go ahead and move forward and talking about how to actually write code in Java. So let's start to get our hands a little dirty here. So right here we have an example of a very simple hello.java program. So just essentially we're implementing in this file called hello.java, we create a class which we call hello, and then within these curly braces we're writing public static void main, which takes as its arguments some array of strings called args. So much like we did in C, we're passing in an array of strings. And then we're calling some command here called system.out.println hello Java. So let's go ahead and look at this in our terminal environment. Oops. Actually see what this code looks like in the terminal and then run it. All right, so if we pull up hello.java, so this code now commented. So we see that the entire program is being contained within a class, which has the same name as the file. This is the format that all of our Java files are going to take. So if you implement some Java file called hello.java, then you do need to enclose everything within a class called the same name as the file name. So in this case, hello. We create a main function here, much likely we would in C. We'd write something like int main in C. Here, instead of just placing the return type of the function, we also include these keywords public and static, and then provide, rather than int arg C, char star arg V, we just provide an array of string objects. And then here we just print hello CS50. So if the syntax of those commands seems a little foreboding at first, that's quite all right. We'll get around to explaining all of this. So if you're saying, like, public static void main, what is going on here? I never want to write code in Java ever. Like, just calm down, relax. We're going to get around to all of that, and you'll understand it soon enough. So any particular questions right now about the structure of this? Particular keywords you don't need to worry about too much just now, but this example is just to motivate that we do, in fact, have this very similar structure to the way we write programs in C. Within Java. Okay. So let's move ahead. Oh, and just referring back to some of these things we're seeing here in this other file. So Java is an object-oriented programming language. We've already covered that. So you'll note that our entire program is contained within a class. And within this class, we have some function, which in Java we actually refer to as a method. So whenever I say method, just know that I'm referring to something which we'd call a function in C. And each of these classes can contain methods as well as fields. Fields are equivalent to variables. And so essentially this program, which is being implemented in the form of a class, you can just think of that as something which contains variables, which we refer to as fields, and functions, which we refer to as methods. So that's not so bad. And we'll get around to moving beyond the abstraction of some of those other terms we were using soon enough.
Is there any particular reason that M is in capital and F is in lowercase?
Microsoft Office autocorrect is why. So M is capitalized here for absolutely no reason. So don't worry about that. I just forgot to go back and change it after Microsoft changed it for me. Okay, any other questions? Okay. Oh, and just to address more of the syntax now, so we don't worry too much about it. Public and static, those are special properties of things in a class. So it just, some special keywords that assign special properties to this particular method which is contained in the class. And we will we'll further motivate that later on so we can see why exactly this is happening, and that those words you can just kind of wave your hands at for now. Just know that void is the return type, main is some method, and these are the parameters just as it enclosed within the parentheses, just as we would pass any parameters to a function in C. Okay, so once more, don't panic. It's all going to be okay. We'll get around to that next. So how are we actually going to compile and run this program? So we use the Java compiler, which on our system is just Java C, and then we pass in the name of the file, which contains our source code, and this is going to create a file called hello.class. And that contains our actual Java bytecode, which is run by the Java virtual machine. So then to run it in the Java virtual machine, we just write Java hello. So this will produce a file called hello.class. And then when the Java virtual machine receives this argument hello, it's going to look for hello.class, and it's going to run that. So that's how we execute the bytecode using the Java virtual machine. So that's what causes the virtual machine to start interpreting that code. And it'll cause that to the computer to run the program. So if we just try that right now. So Java C, hello.java. Okay, so it takes a second, but the compiler does in fact produce hello.class, and then we run it by just writing Java hello, not hello.class, and hello CS50. So we just wrote our first program in Java. Okay, any questions about what we just saw there? Okay, so compilation and running, it's not all that different from what you've seen before, except that instead of just running hello, like you might be used to doing with C, after you compile a program in C, you can just run it. You don't need to provide any other arguments. You actually do have to provide the interpreter, this Java virtual machine, because the computer by itself cannot understand that code, but the virtual machine can. It sort of acts as the bridge between the processor and this code which you've written. Yes? Yeah, everything is case sensitive. So if I wrote Java in all caps, I think the terminal would complain because Java is not a command. Yeah, Java command not found. So lowercase Java, and then by convention, we generally make these Java files start with a capital letter. So that obviously could be done differently, but that's generally how we do it by convention and how I'll be doing it for the duration of the seminar. Okay, any other questions? Okay, cool. So, thanks. Okay, so using classes. So the great thing about Java is that you can bring in code from other classes. So we just implemented a class called hello, which had a function within it that would print out hello CS50 to the terminal. But there are a lot of other classes as well. And we can take advantage of the code which is placed within those classes in the form of methods of those classes by importing all the contents of other classes which have already been written. So if I want to use some method, we'll say it's called method 1, which is contained in some class, which we'll call class 0, then I can just include the appropriate package as what we'd refer to as some package containing a series of classes, and then call that method using this notation here where we include the name of the class which we just imported, followed by a dot, followed by the name of the method, which is like a function, and then parameters in these parentheses. So we essentially are able to call this method by specifying the class it's contained within that we imported, and then the name of the method, and then call it. So let's take a look at an example.
What's
yes?
The three periods, like,
oh, that's an ellipse, dot, dot, dot. So there's some more that you have to write before then. We'll show what it actually looks like. Yeah, the question was just why is the ellipse there? And
is
unclear.
Local? Is it global? Like, is it like on my computer, or is it on the internet or something?
I'll actually show you that in this example. So the question was, is the class local? Is it located on my computer somewhere? Or is it global? Can I get it? So Java has a standard set of classes which it can access just out of the box. So if you write something like import java.lang.math, This is a package which is included in the Java base language. So this is something that you're always able to include, much in the same way that on C you can always write something like pound include stdio.h. Java has a vast repository of these header files, I guess, that contain code that you can just link in without having to worry about anything else. If you wanted to make use of classes which you wrote yourself, you would have to place those class files in the same directory, and we'll talk about how to do that in a subsequent example. Okay, so here's what importation of some other class actually looks like. So we have a math package which we want to make use of, and we can import it by writing import java.lang.math. If you find some class that you want to make use of on the internet, which is generally where you're going to find these sorts of things, the documentation will generally tell you how to import it, and you just include that line near the top of the file outside of the class itself, and that code will be linked in for your use. And when you compile, it'll link in that code and make it so that when you run it through the interpreter, it'll work. So this is sort of an analog to pound include math.h, for example. Okay. And then if I look below here to see what I'm making use of, so it seems that I am calling some function, or method rather, in the class math called random. And what this does is return a double value between 0 and 1, not including 1 but including 0. And I'm multiplying that value by 10 and then casting it to an int. So I end up with some number between 0 to 10 as a double, which I then cast to an int. So what does this do? Oh, I commented it. What an unfortunate habit I've gotten into. So essentially what happens is, since we're generating a double, which is somewhere between 0 and 10. We end up with a value somewhere between 0 and 9.9999 infinitely repeating. And then when we cast that to an integer using this typecast operator, which is the same as what we saw in C, it truncates that, so it cuts off everything after the decimal point, so we end up with a number between 0 and 9. So essentially what I'm doing is making use of a method which already exists, which has been implemented by someone else in this math class, and I'm importing it into my program so that I can very easily exploit that code to generate a number between 0 and 9. So I'm making use of something someone else has already solved to solve a similar problem. And Java makes this very easy to do because we have this vast repository of classes with useful methods within them. Yes?
Using like the string argument for main as an example, right? Because it seems like it's not actually using it, right?
Okay. So yeah, I'm passing in this parameter here, string args. So this this function supports accepting some number of strings as an argument. It's not actually being used by the program. This year in CS50, we've been introducing the idea of providing void as in the list of parameters in your main function, which is good practice because it just explicitly says you're not taking any parameters. But even if you're not making use of parameters, you can still write that you can accept any. So essentially, this program would take any string arguments at the command line. It just wouldn't do anything with them. So I believe you could also place void within the parameters list in Java as well. But you can also just put string array args, and then it allows you to take input. Yeah, there's no particular reason that I chose to include that in this example.
So rather than like blinking dot like C, right? Like the blinking cursor, like if you say it takes a command line, then it's just like never
mind. What do you mean by the blinking cursor?
Because like if we said that like a main takes like a string like in C, like you would have to like you could run it like random.java and something else.
Yes. Well, you can do that. So this essentially implements the same functionality as placing int argc and charstar argb in C's main parameters. So you could, if we were using this, and in fact you still can, you can include command line arguments after the name of your file, and you would be of your program, and you would be able to use those arguments. So yeah, that's essentially the same thing. We're not using it in this example, but yes, this is placed here because Java does support command line arguments, which you can pass into your program. Okay. Any other questions about what's being done here? Yes?
When compiling Java, do you have to note the, I guess, what you import, like in the C?
So it actually tends to just take care of itself. Yeah. So just because I'm importing this doesn't mean I have to explicitly say that I'm linking anything in at compile time to the Java C compiler. You'll note, in fact, that if I just write Java C hello.java, or random.java, rather, that it does, in fact, go about it, and it works. And just to justify that it is giving a random number, it changes each time I run it. So look at that. And then just below here, you'll notice, once again, we're printing to the screen, and we're writing system.out.println. So in light of what we just learned here, we're able to call a method that's contained within a class. You can see that println itself is also a method contained within a class. The system.out class being contained within the system class, which is just something that's given to us by default, so we didn't even have to import it. We can just use system.out. And it contains this method that allows us to print to the screen, which is very useful. Hey, yes?
What's the plus
during the plus? This plus, much like in JavaScript, it's a concatenation operator. So essentially what's happening here is we're printing out the string have a random number, and then concatenating to this string the value random. So we're just essentially adding to the end of this string the string representation of this number. So we're printing out this and then a number. So that's actually something that C would not let you do, but which Java does allow you to do. So it's an example of where one of the areas in which the syntax does differ a little bit in Java from C. Yes?
Random is an integer, but it doesn't matter because it's just concatenated.
It actually doesn't matter. You can just concatenate it like this, and it'll print out fine. So you can concatenate between types, and it'll just place them together as a string and then print them out.
Right, say if random was a string, do you need to put quotation marks?
So if random is a string, I hesitate to say variable because it's an object in Java, but yeah, so if these were two strings, so for example, if I were to create a string, like in C, you might write string str equals ABC. So then you would just write str plus random. You wouldn't have to put quotes around str, because by putting quotes around something, you're asserting, I literally mean these characters. I don't mean a variable called this. So if you have some variable which stores a string, then you just include the name of the variable rather than placing it in quotes, even if it is a string. Okay. Any other questions about that? Okay, cool. Let's move on to the next thing then. All right, so we've seen how we can make use of methods that are contained in other classes. So let's take a look at some other examples of useful classes we might want to use when we're in Java, just to really hammer this home. So another example is the scanner. So what does a scanner do exactly? No one gets the reference. Okay, that's fine. Scanner Darkly, check it out. Great movie. Okay, good. okay, so a scanner is a class which we can use to create an object which sees input from a stream. And when I see a stream, I mean something that we can get input from. So an example would be system.in, which you might know as stdin or standardin. So if you're not familiar with that terms, you don't remember them, standardin is just anything that's passed in from the keyboard. So if I start typing things on my keyboard right now on my laptop, I'm passing each of these characters into the standard input stream, and my computer is pulling input from that stream. And if I'm printing things out to the terminal, that all those characters are being output to the standard out stream. So anytime you're printing out or accepting input, you're reading in from some sort of stream. So those two streams are maybe the most important ones because it's what we're most used to seeing, the input stream from the user and the output stream to the screen. We can imagine various other streams. And if you recall from the man pages for a lot of our file IO functions, which we used in C, you recall that a lot of them included as a parameter a file star, which they referred to as stream. So anytime you get a file handle, that's also a stream, because that's something else you can write to or read from, right? It's just a sequence of characters which you pull from and then move along to get the next information or to write the next information. Any questions about that idea before we move forward? Yeah, well, it's anything that you are getting input from or to which you can write output. It's not even necessarily provided by the user. For example, you read from a dictionary stream in speller.c, week 6's problem set. So you were pulling in a stream of data from a file that already existed that the user was not providing you. So when I refer to a stream, I'm just referring to something you can take input from or which you can send output to. And the only ones you really need to know for the purposes of our seminar today are system.in, which is standard in, system.out, which is standard out, or a file stream. Yeah, so what scanner actually does is it takes in input from some stream. And it takes a look at that, and it can return the next line or next integer or whatever that's contained within that stream. And if we hook it up with the standard input stream, system.in, we're able to get input from the user from the keyboard.
So is it like kind of the middle thing between standard in and standard out?
Yeah, so the question was, is it sort of a middleman between standard in and standard out? And perhaps more accurately to say that your program is the middleman between standard in and standard out. And which is, I suppose, following this analogy, a scanner is sort of like system.in's agent, so you get in contact with the input stream using scanner because he knows how to get in touch with them. And then you can do something else with your program, and later on we'll see how you can go to your buddy PrintWriter, and he knows how to get to standard out, so you can, you know, sort of forward the message along and get things done. That's how it works in this town. Okay, so if we pull open another example, we can see how this works with scanner. So we'll go to io, pull open scannerdemo.java. And so the point of this is to see how we can use a class to create an object that we can do things with. And if that seems a little odd that we're creating objects out of classes now when I talked about how we used classes previously, don't worry about it. Just go with it for now, and that'll be the very next thing we cover, I promise. Okay, so what's happening here is we are creating a scanner. So we're treating this just like a struct, essentially, called input scanner. And then the way we're instantiating this is by writing new scanner, which takes as an argument system.in. So we're effectively creating an object of type scanner or of class scanner and giving it the name input scanner. And now we have this scanner that we've created that we can start making use of. We can start calling its methods. We're accessing its fields if it had any interesting fields we wanted to keep track of. So if you created an array object in JavaScript for pset 8, you might recall this syntax where you'd write new array, for example, and it would take an empty list of parameters or perhaps a list of parameters containing something. Okay, so then how do we use it? So right now I can create a string object. Objects tend to have these capitalized names for the classes. So we create a string object, a string n, and we set that equal to input scanner.nextLine. So what's happening here is we're calling the method nextLine on our input scanner, and we're calling it on input scanner in particular rather than just the scanner class, because our input scanner is an instantiation of this class, so it's an object that's already been hooked up to system.in. So this is a scanner which is working with system.in, so if we call the method nextLine on this particular scanner, what's going to happen is it's going to get a line from system.in, so some line the user typed in and then pressed enter, that constitutes a line. So it'll wait for that line and then grab it from the user. So this is essentially like a get string, which we used in the CS50 library quite frequently. And then since that's stored in n, we actually have an example now where we are in fact storing a string in some string object which we call n, and we're concatenating here. So if we go ahead and run this example, javac scannerdemo.java, and then java scannerdemo, it'll ask us to type in a string. So what's happening right now is that we're executing the line input scanner.nextLine, I believe. So it pauses and waits for me to type in a line into the standard input stream right here. So I type in this just nonsense phrase. And then when I hit enter, a line has officially been entered into standard input. And now the program has read in that line, stored it in the string n, and then concatenated it into this output. So we've successfully taken in input from the user using our scanner object. And then we've stored it somewhere and then used that to print out a unique string.
What was print ln?
Oh, I'm sorry, I should have highlighted the distinction here. So system.out has two different functions for printing. We have print, which just prints this out, and then we have println, or print line. Can anyone guess what the difference is, actually? What's that? Yeah, so essentially the only difference between print and println is that println is going to create a new line after it's done printing. So it's essentially going to put a backslash n at the end of your string by itself. So if you know you want to jump to the next line after you print this out, to save you the trouble of having to write backslash n literally, you can just use println and it'll jump to the next line for you. I used print here because after I printed this out, I wanted the cursor to sit right here to give us this nice interface where the user actually types next to this this line, whatever their input's going to be. And that's just to create a nice UI experience, I guess, if you can call it that, on the terminal. Yeah, so does everyone appreciate that distinction, why that's being used?
How did it know to put a new line after you typed in the string? Like when you
Whenever you press enter after you're done inputting a string on the terminal, it always jumps to the next line like that, no question. Because essentially when you hit enter, it's like you're entering in that new line character. So that just always happens without fail.
So I don't see like why you need to use next line. I mean, like, you're just printing out what you got. You're not printing out like line by line.
Oh, so I mean, I don't actually have to use println here. If I didn't.
Next line, no, the code above that. Yeah, the input scanner next line.
I don't see input like, scanner next line. Where do I?
That's the second last line. The string end.
String n equals input scanner next. I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Next line. Why do you need it?
Dot next line here. Oh, that's good. This isn't creating a new line. This is the method being called in input scanner. So next line is actually the function that's being called right now. That's essentially equivalent to get string.
So do you get the string when you use scanner?
So this is I created a scanner object. That just creates some object that I can go to and ask to do things for me. So essentially what happened was, think of it like this. We'll do it visually. So suppose we have, this person's, here's the keyboard. And I have a better marker here. We have a keyboard, and it's sending information along this cable to the computer. So this is some stream of data. And here's our program working over here, and it's like, oh, there's a stream of data, but we can't really do anything with it. We'll create a scanner object. So this guy, he's got access to the data. He knows how to get to the data, and he's going to give it to us. So we're hooked up with our scanner object, and that's all that's happened here. We've created a scanner. So we've created this guy here that has access to this stream of data. But we're not telling him to do anything with it just yet. When we get to this line, you recall that we can call a method that is contained within a class. And since an object is just the instantiation of a class, it's sort of like an object described by a class, it has all these methods. So now we call next line, which is a method of input scanner. So we're essentially saying, oh, hey, input scanner, get us the next line from this stream of data. And he's like, sure, no problem, buddy. And then he passes back this string, which we then store in n, which we're keeping track of, and then we have this string. So this line is essentially like calling get string in the CS50 library. We just happen to be relying on input scanner to do that job for us. And that is a new idea, and it's a novel concept that we're going to explore a little more in depth next. I just wanted to expose you to this before we went through the syntax notes. Yes?
So what can go wrong with this? Like what terrible error messages can you get? Like if you didn't specify string, does it go automatically to system, like standard in? And if you just called it without instantiating any scanners at all, like what would happen?
So if I just called input scanner.nextline without having created a new scanner? So the question was essentially, what can go wrong here? So we'll entertain a couple of those ideas. So what if I had not created a new scanner here and I just had this line that's like, hey, I have an input scanner, that's kind of like creating a pointer to an object and then never making an object. So this is just this thing that, like, it wants to hold an object, but you never made one for it. So it's just sort of this awkward scanner pointer or something. We don't have pointers in Java, so when I say that, it's an analogy. There are no pointers in Java. I'm just relating this back to something we've already used before. So this is just sort of like a handle for some scanner object, but since we never created one, it doesn't work. So if we tried to call next line here, we end up getting some problems. So if I run this, yeah, so see, we're trying to, variable input scanner might not have been initialized. So it's never been initialized to actually be an object, so it's not even going to compile. We get a compilation error.
So you don't get any junk, it just doesn't even compile.
Right? Yeah, in this case, it doesn't even compile. The other question was, what if we just didn't pass in a parameter to scanner? I don't recall off the top of my head. I think it might place system.in there by default. Let's go ahead and take a look and see if that's what happens. Nope. In fact, it cannot find this constructor because it expects this constructor, and we'll talk about what it means when I say constructor to have an argument, and since it doesn't have one, it's not going to let it happen. So we can get compiler errors here if we don't set things up correctly. So that's basically how we can screw this example up if we wanted to, which we did. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so let's now that we've seen this in sort of an operation within a program, let's take a step back and actually talk about what these objects and classes which we've been playing around with really are, how that's working. Okay, so what is a class? So we talked about how our programs are classes before, because we when we create some file hello.java, we create a class hello, which contains all our methods and our fields, which are variables, essentially, and methods are essentially functions for our program. So a class doesn't have to be your entire program. It can be just the description of some object. So what do I mean when I talk about an object? Well, I mean something that has some certain properties and also some methods which are used in conjunction with those properties. So it's sort of like a struct. You recall in C we had these structs which essentially allowed you to create like this basket of variables. An object is just a little more powerful because now you can give those baskets some behavior. So for example, if you have like the variables x, y, z in your basket, you can have some like special like button on that basket that like adds up the values of x, y, and z and then shouts it at you. So it's like a kind of like a super basket, I guess. This is rapidly becoming a terrible metaphor, but hopefully it helps someone else out to visualize this. Yeah, if anyone can find such a basket, let me know. I can include it in next year's seminar. So a class is essentially a description of an object. And an object is an instantiated class. So it's the real deal. It's like we took this description of an object and we made it into an actual thing. So it's the realization of the object described with a class. And why would we want to do this? What's the real difference? Because they're both sort of abstract things. They live in the computer. One's a description of an object, and the other's the actual object. Well, the difference is we say the class has certain fields. When we create an object, it actually has those fields. So we actually have like these set of variables that are contained with it, which we can access and do things with. So it's really the difference between having like a blueprint of a house and actually having a house that you've built and placed in the middle of nowhere. So does anyone appreciate the metaphor that you appreciate the reference clearly. Yeah, this is the Bluth model home for those not familiar. It's top notch. All right, so high quality stuff. Yeah, they got some great contracting deals overseas. Essentially, a class is something that describes some object. You can think of it as being a physical thing if you want to. Obviously, it's not because it exists in the computer, but it is this actual structure that contains data, and the class just essentially tells us how to build it. Okay. So, all right. So, just to reiterate what I was just saying, a particular object's fields are its own. So, changing the field of one object would not affect any others. So, if I created two objects from one class, these are distinct from each other. So, I can set up, for example, a Cartesian point with x and y having values 3 and 2, and some other point having the values 5 and 8. So, I can set up x and y for this object. And they're distinct from this other XY for this other object. So we're creating essentially our own individual implementations of these classes, which are separate from each other. So they have the same structure because they're of the same class, but they are distinct and can modify each of them separately. So it's like we have our very own point here and a separate point that they're completely separate from each other. Okay. Yes, we are. We're going to do a little more with just using objects. and doing a little more with file IO, but then we'll move forward to actually creating our own objects and making use of them. That's a good question. All right. But like I said, before we get to that, let's take a look at just one more program that's making use of objects before we dive headlong into actually creating our own, and consider one which makes use not only of user input, but which allows us to create output, so linking up with a file and placing something there after having read something in from the user. So this will require an additional object, because scanner can only take things in as input. It can't write things out. Okay, so this is essentially an implementation of one of the worst word processors ever conceived by man. And you'll see, well, I'll show you how it works, actually. So if we run this, just to give you an idea of what it is we're dealing with, and then I write Java typewriter. So it says type in a line and hit enter to print to the file. And since I need a way to get out of here, if I type this special string rage quit, it actually quits out of the program for me. So I can just write things like, this is the first line. And it does give us that old-timey typewriter experience. This is the second line. This program is kind of stupid. and then rage quit. And it did get us out of here. So now we have this new file called output.txt. And if I just open that up really quickly in Nano, we do see that it created the first line, the second line, and the third line that I typed in. And all these were included on this nice piece of parchment that is implemented in a text file that was accessed by our typewriter program. So let's take a look at how exactly we did that just now. So in C, this would have involved opening a new file and getting a stream to that file, and then getting access to the input stream using functions like getString, and then pulling that information in and then writing it out to the other file. It's a little bit cleaner in Java. It's honestly not that bad to do in C either, but by using objects, we sort of get this nice abstraction where we're using a scanner to take an input for us, and then using something called a printwriter to push that out. So you know those here, printwriter is actually something that's found in java.io, and I could have written .printwriter, but to expose you to some more syntax, if I just write .star, I get everything contained within java.io, and since that includes printwriter, I also have access to that. So within my typewriter class, I'm creating a scanner. So scanner in equals new scanner system.in. So I'm getting access to the input field coming in from the keyboard. Okay, easy enough. That's what we were just doing before. I'm also now creating another object called out, which is of a class printwriter. And printwriter works very similarly to scanner, except we can pass in as an argument the name of some file we want to write to. So in this case, it's output.txt. So if that doesn't exist already, we're going to create the file output.txt, and we're going to start writing to it. Okay, so we have this output object as well now. And then we're storing any input from the user in this string called line. Okay, so then we print out some instructions to the user. Apparently, I decided to call this TypeMax Pro 2nd Edition when I wrote this back in the day. So we get the first line of user input. Next line, this is just to take care of how the loop works. And until line equals rage quit, this is interesting, by the way, because line is just a string, right? So I'm calling a method on something that's just a string, and we're used to strings being char stars, and char stars don't have methods. So does anyone have an explanation for how I'm doing this? Do you have an explanation, Justin? So a string is an object. So you'll notice that when I create a string up here, string line, string is capitalized just like the other classes I'm using to specify what type my objects are. A string is also an object in Java. It's not an array of chars. It's something more than that. It's an object which contains not only an array of chars, but some fields such as length. So it keeps track of its own length, so I can just ask it what its length is rather than repeatedly calculating it. It also contains some useful methods, which we might want to use with that string. That includes a method called equals, which is essentially implementing str comp equals zero. So if I write bang line equals rage quit, I'm essentially asking, is the string in line not rage quit? And if that's true, then I continue looping. But if it is rage quit, then I quit out ragefully. All right, does anyone have a... Okay, does that make sense? Cool. All right, so then we output the last line to our file. That's the last thing we got in. Then we type out Bada Ra Ching. read in the next line of input, and we continue until the user types out rage quit. All right, and then we call these close methods on our scanner in and our print writer out. Much like we close our streams in C using fclose, we close them in Java as well using these methods, which belong to the scanner and the print writer respectively. And this completes the implementation of what we just did. Any questions about this implementation or anything that we're doing with the objects in this program?
Why do you need to close it when you have it, like, what's the concept behind closing something?
So it's just sort of, you're just kind of supposed to do it. It's just good practice to close the streams that you've opened after you've opened them up. Essentially, this is so that it has something to do with being not having these open streams that you're already accessing if other programs are accessing them at the same time. So it's just very nice to be able to, like, close those off and say you're done writing to them. Yeah. So I don't have a much more satisfying answer to you at this point than just to say that it's just good practice and it's generally what you should be doing. There's definitely more sophisticated explanations that go a little deeper under the hood, but I don't have that prepared for you this time. All right. Okay, any other questions about this? Okay, so let's move on. Before we move on too far, just to take a look at, it's in objects. So if I ex string objects demo.java, if we, string object demo. If we look very quickly just in this file here, so when strings are objects, possibilities are endless, you can actually, there's actually some very interesting functionality available in strings in terms of methods. So if I have the string, narwhals have horns, and then I want to get in individual substrings out of that, I can call something like substring, which gets everything from 0 but before 8, for example, and that prints out just narwhals. From 14 to just before 19 gets horns, and the narwhal horns I can get by concatenating these two things. So this is just to further motivate that when we make when we have such prevalence of objects within the language, we can do some remarkable things, because rather than having to actually implement this functionality, we can we can go ahead and call these methods and and call these methods and just have that given to us a priori and work with it. So this is one of the nice things of working with objects in JavaScript, or in Java, pardon me.
How do I know, like, what kind of fields each object has?
What sort of methods are available in each object?
Or fields.
Okay, or objects or fields? Okay, so you can find out information about what's contained in any particular class or object in Java just by essentially Googling it.
Are they all the same, or are they different? Like,
It's vastly different, because the methods are going to be particular to any object or class, and since we're going to be writing our own classes and objects, we might be including fields or methods that are included in just our object that aren't in any other object that's been implemented. So it does wildly vary, and you can find out information about any particular class by just going online and looking up the documentation of it. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Okay, so let's move ahead and actually make our own object. So let's actually start using object orientation to our advantage and create our own classes and objects so we can make our own programs with them. So we'll start simple. We'll just talk about a 2D Cartesian point, for example. So we can have some point in the 2D plane that we can represent using Cartesian coordinates, so just x and y coordinates, thinking back to geometry. And any point just has an x value, a y value, and the property that it's a certain distance from the origin. So for any point, we need to know its x value and its y value. And for any point, we can also calculate somehow using some function, some computable function, what the distance of that point is from the origin, which is just the square root of x squared plus y squared. And we'll see that in the code in a second. All right, so that seems like it's relatively easy to implement. So let's go ahead and take a look at the implementation. So if we open up Emacs point.java, okay, so in this file, point.java, I'm implementing a class called point. And notice that this isn't really a program because there's no public static main or public static void main method. It's just sort of a a description of an object. And we've created private static variable or private variables here. Sorry, they're not static variables, actually. These are just private variables which represent the coordinates of our point. So we have a private variable x and a private variable y, both of type int. And we have a constructor method. And this sets up the initial conditions of our newly created point object. So essentially, when we call new point, what's actually being run is this on our new object. And what this does is take in these two arguments. You recall that the constructor method for scanner took in as an argument system.in, and it set up the scanner appropriately, so it worked with that stream. When we create a point, we're going to be able to provide an x and a y argument, and it's going to set the particular fields within this class or object to be in at x and in at y. So it allows us to essentially set up our object when we're instantiating it such that it contains these particular values in its fields. So when we create a point, we can tell it we want it to be the point 2, 3, or 4, 5 or something. And then we have a public method here, which prints out the, I say length as if this were a vector. So the length of the shortest distance path between the origin and the point in the plane. And this just prints out, using some handy methods from math again, the square root of x to the second power plus y to the second power, so square root of x squared plus y squared, and this ends up printing the length. So, yes?
Sorry, you've probably covered this before, but what's the difference between public and private?
We haven't really covered it too in-depth just yet, actually, so it's a very good question. So the question was, what is the difference between private and public? So this is a good time to cover that, actually. So a private variable is something that cannot be accessed outside of the class. So you'll recall we can access particular methods within a class by writing something like, for example, math.random. So we can access random because it's been made public. And similarly, if these were public variables, we could write something like, string.length. And that would allow us to get access to this public variable that's stored within the class. By making it private, you can't do that. You can only access these variables from within this class. So that means any of these methods that are contained within the object can get to it. It's private to this scope, but no one else can touch it. And since we have a public method here, anyone can find out what the length is from the distance from the origin to this point, but no one can actually access x and y individually.
Can I understand like public as in its output, since it's like letting other people see it, and private as in input, because that's the thing that only you can edit?
So you shouldn't really think of it in terms of input or output, because I could have also made x and y public here. I just chose not to, partially to motivate this discussion. So private, you can think of things as just things the object holds onto and keeps track of by itself, but that it doesn't want to share with anyone else. So if you have sensitive information stored in an object that you don't want anyone to be able to just reach in or modify, perhaps, you'd make it private. And you can control access to it by creating public methods. So I can still implement a public method that allows someone to change x. It's just they have to go through the public method to do it rather than doing it themselves. Yes?
So we can think of it somewhat like, say, variables inside a function.
Hmm?
So we can think of it something like variables inside a function in C.
Yeah, the question was, can we think of it sort of like variables that are stored inside of a function? And you can sort of think of it like that, though realize that these private variables persist as well with the object. So whereas if you created a local variable within a function, sure, you can't modify it directly because it's being controlled by the function, but it also goes away after the function terminates. After you finish calling a method, these variables still persist and exist within the object. You just can't access them directly. You have to go through the methods because they're private. Okay, so the next question was whether there was a way to return things from methods, because we've primarily been using methods so far which just return void. So if I made this an int, for example, so made the return type int, we could also just return a number in the same way that we have done before using in C. So let's actually go ahead and just do that, and we'll change the other file that we're going to start working in so that it accommodates this, just to give an example of a non-void method to further motivate that they are equivalent to what we use as functions in JavaScript, or in Java. I need to stop saying that. Okay, so now we've changed this method so that it actually returns the length by returning this computation here. So we'll end up getting an int value. Okay, so let's, this probably won't be, right. Yeah, all right.
What if you call, can you call print left without calling point, or HTTP.
So you can't, so you wouldn't really be able to call print length without having instantiated an object, because then you wouldn't have access to these x and y variables, and it wouldn't really make sense. Right, let's back out of here for a moment and actually look at the example, which is using this class, so that it'll make a little more sense. So in this other file, which is in fact a program called point demo, you'll see that within our main function, we're creating a point called myPoint using this constructor method, new point, which takes as arguments 6 and 8. So init x becomes 6, init y becomes 8. And then a print length had been a void function, but we changed it so it returns an int. So now we'll just write system.out.println. So we're printing out this value, which is being returned by this instead. And this should still work. Let's go ahead and verify that. And it should be 10, I believe. Yeah, and we do, in fact, get 10 out there. So what just happened was we created a point object. We set as its initial x and initial y values 6 and 8. 6 times 6, 36. 8 times 8, 64. Gets 100, square root of which is 10. So myPoint.println, despite the name, since we changed the method, now returns that value, and then we're printing it out, and we get 10 on the screen. So essentially, we were able to bring in this point class to instantiate a point object because these two things are contained within the same file. So because we have point.java and point.demo.java here, when we compiled point.demo.java, the compiler noticed that we made use of point, and since point is contained in the same file, it brought that code in as well. So without having to explicitly link anything in, we were able to pull in the information about that class. So if you want to implement another class that's used in your file, for example, in point.demo.java, we're obviously making use of point. You just need to include the implementation of the class in your Java source code within the same directory when you're compiling, and that'll get linked in. Any questions about how we just did that? Okay. Let's take a step back and recap on that then. So we made use of a constructor method, which is called when we write something like point, my point equals new point xy. So that constructor method, which we call by writing new and then the name of the class, and then in parentheses providing arguments, which shares the name of the class, is immediately called when the object is created. So by running new point and assigning that to some point which we're creating, we're instantiating an object, and that method is immediately being run to set up the object in some way so that it's ready for our use. So it's essentially a way of the object setting itself up. It sort of constructs itself in this initial state based on the parameters we passed in. So in the point example, it set itself up by setting its x and y value to what we specified. Is everyone happy with that explanation? Does that make sense? Any questions if you don't, because this is really the low-level stuff in object-oriented programming, which is important. Okay, and to reiterate, public and private, these keywords simply refer to whether or not this method or field is going to be accessible from outside of the class. If something is public, it is accessible from outside of the class. A constructor method is always public for obvious reasons. You're only going to want to call constructor methods from outside of class. And a private method or field is one which is not accessible from outside. So it can perhaps be accessed by public methods, so there's an indirect way the user can get to that information, perhaps. But you can't just write, for example, point.x or point.y and get that variable like we would with a C struct, unless we make it public, in which case we can do something like string.length, which does in fact give us that information in a string object. So by specifying whether something's public or private, we control whether or not the user can access it using that dot notation. Any questions about any of this? Okay, so we feel like we have a good grasp on the point object and how we've implemented that using classes. All right, so seeing that we do, we'll move on to something a little more sophisticated. And anyone who's ever watched one of my sections or been to one of my sections knows that when I say I want to do a sophisticated demo, it means I want to start playing Pokemon. So Pokemon are among my favorite objects. And they're objects because they have properties which we can represent in fields. and they have methods, which can be represented as like attacks and stuff. So like every Pokemon has some number of hit points. They have a set of moves. They have a name, which can be represented as a string. They have a type, which can be represented as a string or as a number, since there's a finite number of types. They have PP points, they have experience points, and we can represent all of these within an object because we have all of these different fields which are related to each other. So we can unify them in just this one data structure, an object, which contains not only fields but methods. So not only can the Pokemon not only does the Pokemon have this information associated with it, but we can actually do things with it by calling methods on that Pokemon that rely on its specific information. So let's take a look at a demo I've prepared, which allows us to actually create a Pokemon object. And so we can just see where we're going with this. If we create pokemondemo.java using our Java compiler and run it. Okay, so welcome to the world of Pokemon. Are you a boy or a girl? As the game always starts, what Pokemon would you like to start with? So we can actually specify what we want. Does anyone have a favorite Pokemon? Don't say Mudkip.
Mudkip.
No. Okay.
Squirtle.
All right, that's one of the original ones. That's a good Pokemon. All right. So what type is Squirtle?
Water.
It's a water type. All right. So, okay, here you are. Here's the information about your Pokemon. So we're actually calling a method here, which prints out the information about Pokemon. So all this is scripted, and we're just taking info from the user. And then we print out this formatted text, which has the name of the Pokemon, the type of the Pokemon, and then their hit points initially, which is actually always just 40 out of 40. So that is scripted. Okay, so how is this working exactly? Well, let's take a look at Pokemon demo first, since that's what we're running. Okay, so we're importing a scanner. We have this class, which has the same name of the file, called Pokemon demo. We're instantiating a scanner, so we're creating this scanner object by calling this constructor method. Maybe this line makes a little more sense now that we've motivated it and sort of built up some knowledge about what these constructor methods actually look like. It takes as an argument system in, so it sets up this scanner such that it links into the keyboard input. Then we call some println functions just so we print things to the screen, just printf calls basically. Then we assign to the string Pokemon choice in.nextLine. So this is where we're asking them what Pokemon they want to start with. So we have them type in Squirtle, for example. And then we store in the string Pokemon choice, Squirtle, and then print out this line asking what type of Pokemon that is. We allow the user to tell us what type it is, storing that in a different string. And then we print out, okay, here's some information about the Pokemon. And then we create a Pokemon object at this point, so an object MyPokemon of class Pokemon. Using this Pokemon constructor method that we apparently wrote in some other file, which takes the name of the Pokemon, the number 40, and type. So number 40, just because it's a level 5 Pokemon, it doesn't have many hit points, so we just started off, obviously. And then we call the printInfo method for that Pokemon, which we've just created, and that prints that info in a nicely formatted set of strings on the screen. And then we close our input stream, as we always do. Okay. So we're apparently using this Pokemon class that we've implemented somewhere else. So that might be interesting to look at. So let's pull that open now. So much in the same way that we implemented that point class in some other file, we're implementing this Pokemon class here as well. And it's a little more complicated. It has a larger set of fields. We have a name. We have hit points, so the number of hit points the Pokemon currently has, as well as its maximum hit points. And then a string that contains the type of the Pokemon. So we have our Pokemon constructor. So this takes as arguments the initial name of the Pokemon, the initial hit points it has, and the type of the Pokemon. So then we set up all of these fields that contain the initial states, the initial values for these fields for this Pokemon that's been described. So the name is set to the initial name we've been passed. The hit points are set to the initial hit points, as well as the max hit points set to the initial hit points. We assume the Pokemon is at full health when we get it from Professor Oak. He takes care of his Pokemon. Then we set the type to the initial type, so the type that was passed in this case, water. So then we have set up our Pokemon such that all of these private variables, private fields, do have values. So then we have a Pokemon object, and this object also has a method that is publicly available, which prints out the info of the Pokemon. So it prints out name is a type, and then the hit points, which are full when we start out. So we just print out HP, max HP, which happen to be the same value at first. Yes?
Do
object the entire class or just that the Pokemon like constructing method? Because it seems like you only like really get into like.
So the object encompasses everything that's in this class, which means that it has its own copy of all these methods, and it also has its own copy of each of these values. So when we create a Pokemon object, what happens is we actually get this actual object, which contains a name, hit points, max hit points, a type, and both a constructor method, as well as all the other methods that are defined. So we end up getting, we'll just say methods as well. So we get our own copies of all these variables, and we also get our copies of these functions, which can be used on our particular fields. So you'll note that when we actually create this, the only thing that's being executed is this constructor method. That's because the constructor method is special, and it runs immediately when the object is being created. But what's also happening in that same line is that we're actually instantiating this object. So we have this object, and this just happens to be the first thing we run. So we've created an object, and then we specify this is what we want to happen immediately, because we do need to set up our object in a certain way. So we have this nice way of constructing our object upon its initialization, so that we do, in fact, set it up the way we specified we'd like to in our parameters. So everything you see in this class ends up in the object, or at least a copy of it does. So we can access all of these methods from my Pokemon, as well as all the fields that belong to that Pokemon now.
So after you instantiate the object, can you call the method printInfo yet without calling the method Pokemon?
So calling the method Pokemon actually serves to instantiate the object. It's sort of a, they're sort of one and the same. If we look at PokemonDemo.java, you recall that if I didn't have the rest of this line, this doesn't really do anything. I sort of have a handle to a Pokemon object that doesn't exist because I've never instantiated it. And by actually calling this constructor method in this way with this new keyword, I'm effectively creating this object and simultaneously running this constructor method, or at least that is how you can think about it. So it's sort of an all-in-one operation. We create the object and we initialize it using its constructor method. The constructor method is intimately linked with the actual creation of the object itself. Is everyone happy with that explanation? Has that cleared up sort of a... Okay-ish. Okay. All right. And there will be time for questions at the end as well if anything like remains unclear. Okay. So is anyone wildly unhappy with something about this demo or what's going on here? Or does that more or less make sense? Do point out any questions you have about the implementation, if you have any. Okay. All right. So more complete programs. So we've seen here how we can bring in a class from somewhere else to sort of instantiate this object. So let's take a look at a sort of a novel use of that, which breaks up the functionality of a program into multiple reusable parts. So obviously our Pokemon class could be reused because we might have multiple programs and want to make use of this Pokemon instructor. But we can make more sophisticated use of methods such that they're doing more interesting things that are more central to the behavior of the program. So let's actually take a look at something a little more sophisticated that we used in CS1 last year that the head TF at the time, Brian Young, took the head on implementing. So if we open up a Hangman directory here, and open up this Hangman game. So we'll run this first, just to give you an idea of what we're working with. So Java Hangman game. Okay, so we have some word here. We get 10 guesses. Throw out some guesses, I guess. Can I get some letters?
A.
A? Oh, not a very good letter. Anything else?
N.
All right, we got an N. Oh, you guys aren't very good at this. What? P? E? Okay, we got some vowels. Let's see. E? All right, we have an E. Woo. What else?
S.
S? Ugh, not S.
R.
R. Okay, we have an R and E. I think someone in the audience is signing to me, but I don't know, I don't understand it. So, come on, guys. T? All right, we got a T.
No,
O. O? Right. So we've got two spaces, then an R-E, then a space, then a T. Did I hear a C? Okay, we got a C. All right. That's actually two spaces in the front. What else? D? All right, here we go. Direct? All right, you'd like to solve the puzzle? All right. Direct, congratulations, you guys got it. Okay, so we've solved the hangman game. So let's actually take a look at how we implement the hangman game now. All right, so let's open up hangmangame.java. So we take a scanner input, we initialize some board. So this is a class we had to implement ourselves, this hangman board. We'll look at that next. Well, let's just take a look at the logic of the game. So we play the game. We have a character in which we store a guess. Well, we have not yet won, and the board, we've not yet lost. So these are methods that are called on the board itself. So the board is keeping track of whether or not we've won or lost so far, or can at least determine that based on the information that it does keep track of. All right, so what else is happening? So we prompt the user to enter another guess. We take their input. We get a line from them, and we take the first character. So we notice we have this... So input.nextLine gives us a string, and then apparently we have this method that's available to a string called char at. So what do you suppose char at 0 does with a string? Yeah, it gives you the very first character, the character at the 0th index of that char array. So that's another useful method which is available to us. Then boolean char found equals board make guess. So we make the guess on the board by providing that character, and apparently this either returns true or false, telling us whether or not it found the character. So if it does find the character, then we print to the user, oh, your guess was found in the answer. Ooh. Else, we say that it doesn't appear in the answer, and we're one step closer to losing, which is kind of sad. And then after we finish, so after this while loop finishes, which is going to... complete execution when either we've won the game or lost the game. I just lost the game. I love how you can just figure out who's playing in a room immediately. Okay, so then we move on to the outside of the loop. So after the game's ended, so we print out what the answer to the game, what the answer to this was. So we get the answer from the board. And if we won, which we can find out using this method again, we print out, congratulations, you won. If we lost, sorry, too many guesses, and you lose. Okay, so that doesn't seem too bad. So let's see how we're actually implementing each of these methods in the hangman board. Okay, so now on this hangman board, we're keeping track of the string answer. We're keeping track of the word choices, so the possible, I guess, the possible words we could use, as well as the actual one we're using. We have a char array, so now we're not actually using a string. We're using a char array, which is not an object. It's just an array of chars. We can have that, too. We just don't have all the fancy methods which we're accustomed to with strings, which are called revealed. We also have an int called wrong guesses, so we keep track of how many wrong guesses the user's made. So presumably if they get to a certain number of wrong guesses, the game ends. I believe it's 10 in this implementation. We also have a number of max wrong guesses, which is probably that 10 value that I just mentioned. And we also have a string in which we keep track of the chars which have already been guessed by the user. Okay, so what sort of methods do we have here? We have fill word choices. This is an early version of this implementation. I believe later on we added an entire dictionary which could be choose from. In fact, right now all we have is using direct initialization, so there were very few words we could have actually seen today. And that's stored in word choices. So we fill up our word choices. So that apparently Brian never quite got to that. this week turned out to be not even before I graduate. Public void choose word. So now we're randomly selecting a word based on the length of word choices. So if this is 7, for example, we multiply that by something between 0 and 1. Does that? Okay, so something's being done here to choose a word from that array. Not actually confident that results in a... Okay, don't worry about it. It's not important. But what this is doing is choosing a word from that array. And then we pull that out to get the actual answer. So we're setting up the game. We then have make blanks, which sets revealed to a new char array. And we fill this initially with these underscores. So we initially start out with an array which just contains underscores. We have this blank string that the user can see so they know where they have not yet successfully guessed the character. A refresh function, which method rather, which resets the game essentially, saying the wrong guesses to zero, guess chars to an empty string again, and remakes the blanks and chooses a new word. Finally, we have our constructor method. So you'll note when the game starts, when we create this board, we set max wrong guesses to 10, which we can change. Perhaps we should define as a constant. We fill the word choices up, and we refresh the game. So we start the game anew with our word choices filled in and our wrong guesses set to some constant value. We also have toString, which is a useful method because it allows us to concatenate everything in our revealed char array to an actual string, which we can then print out to the user. We have getAnswer, which just returns whatever is in the answer field. So you'll note here that even though answer is private, the user can still access it by printing it, by calling the public method getAnswer. So we are allowing the user to get to that. We're just controlling the way they do access it. So in this case, it's a little pointless because the user could just we could just allow the user to get the answer directly. But by doing this, we are returning just a copy of the answer, since this returns a string. So we're passing it by value rather than allowing them to get to our copy specifically. Okay. And then we walk down the revealed looking for blanks, checking if the game has been won yet. If ever we see place in a revealed array that's still an underscore, obviously the game's not over yet, they haven't won yet. Else it's true and they've won. And if they've lost if wrong guesses ever exceeds the maximum number of wrong guesses. And we also see here we've implemented the ability to make a guess by checking whether or not it's in the word. We store whether or not it's in the word. We set that to false initially. We do some stuff here. We look through the actual answer. And if we find that character somewhere within that answer, we decide that it was in fact in the word and change revealed to contain that character. And if it wasn't in the word, we increment the wrong guesses. Okay, so we've essentially, in this class, implemented this game board, which works with the game Hangman, that's encapsulated within this class, which can be instantiated in an object, and allows any other class, any other program we make, to access all of these special methods. So we're sort of exposing this functionality to other classes that want to make use of it. And if I wanted to implement a different version of the Hangman game, I could write my own hangmangame.java file and make use of all the work I've done in this class within that program as well. So I sort of have this nicely encapsulated engine for a Hangman board that's contained within this file. So I have a situation where my all my different parts of my code for my program are nicely encapsulated in these self-sufficient .java files. So herein lies sort of the beauty of using object-oriented programming, because we're not just making some program that contains all this functionality that's contained within itself. We're creating a program where it literally is the sum of its parts, in that we're implementing each different part separately. So we can create a class that handles the Hangman board. If we were writing a larger scale game, we could write a class that takes care of the player character and perhaps all of his Pokemon and perhaps his inventory and various other things, the contents of his backpack, etc. And then we could keep all of these things separately. And if we wanted to write a different game later on where our character still has an inventory but he doesn't have any Pokemon, then we could include what we've already done very naturally by just including that class file and exposing these same methods, which allow us naturally to interact with the contents of this object, because it does contain within itself its own methods for accessing its contents and doing things with it. So it's sort of a data structure that comes with instructions in a way. And this makes writing particular types of code in object-oriented languages very natural and much easier to do than other languages like C, for example, which does not necessarily give you this same functionality. Okay. So just to reiterate what we just saw there, we had a project which consisted of two files. We had Hangman Game, which was the main class. So this is a program that we actually pass to the class file that we actually, or Java file rather, they actually pass to the compiler directly, which included references to Hangman board because it was using that class to instantiate an object. Since that was in the same directory, the Java compiler pulled it in as well. And this was the this board contained the fields and methods relating to the state of the game board itself, which is used in the game, and such as the letters, guess, the secret word, etc. And we were able to keep this encapsulated, but also link it in so we could use it in a larger program. Okay. So that's essentially all the examples and content that we're going to get through for this seminar. So I'll leave the floor open now for any questions about Java that you have remaining, or questions about any of the things we've covered so far today. Who wrote all the methods that are... So I'm sure they're not all open source. But they, well, Java was created by Sun Microsystems, I mentioned in the mid-90s previously, so a lot of the functions that are, or methods rather, that are available in classes, which are available in the Java Standard Library, came from Sun. I'm not sure how the revision process goes by which they contribute new code to that that code base, but yeah, it's been run, essentially managed mostly through Sun Microsystems.
And also the machine, like the virtual machine, like do we have to download it to our computer or...
That's a good question. So the way we've been writing code that I've shown you, we were just right on the cloud. So you can write your code right on the cloud if you like. So you could just use the terminal, use Java and Java C to compile your code and Java to run your code. You can download a Java runtime environment for your own computer if you want to work in some sort of development environment that is on your machine and run it locally. So that option is available to you, but do know that if you want to continue working on the cloud, if that's something that you're familiar with and which you've come to like, that's definitely available for you to continue to do as well. Okay. Yes?
So are Java programs restricted to like terminal, or could you say embed something like that on like web page?
Oh. So the question was, are Java programs restricted to the terminal? And the answer is definitely an emphatic no. You can certainly bring in other libraries that allow you to like create windows and then create graphics. There's actually a really nice package called Java 3D, which I used along with others in some research I did over the summer. We did like a large like 3D simulation. So yeah, you can certainly create visual programs using Java. I didn't go into any particular packages in depth today because I wanted to focus on the core syntax of the language and how to use object-oriented programming. But yeah, you can certainly create visual applications, and with Java it's perhaps easier than in some other languages. So you can certainly do some research on that on your own, or I'll leave my email address up at the end of the video so anyone can contact me if they have further questions as well. But yeah, you can definitely make visual programs in Java. So if you start working with... things like Java 3D, in which case you'd probably likely end up moving beyond the terminal and using some sort of IDE like Eclipse, for example. Eclipse is a good example of an IDE, or NetBeans, which you can use in developing larger Java applications. You could use that. Generally, what's going to happen is you're going to run this this Java file, and you're always going to have output to some like standard output, so like terminal output, like a console. But you can also create windows within the operating system environment and then fill those with graphics. And packages like Java 3D are going to allow you to do things like that. There's other packages available, too, that don't necessarily require like 3D acceleration like Java 3D does, where you're just making simple windows. I can't think of the name of one off the top of my head at the moment, but they're definitely available. And if you want to talk about them later, we can certainly do some research to find particular examples as well. They should be easy to find online, though. Yeah. So allowing the user to dynamically change the class while the program is running, I'm actually not aware of anything like that, or at least not something that requires that wouldn't require some like really intimate knowledge of the system and some sophisticated changing. That's sort of it sounds like you're getting into like some kind of hacker stuff. Yeah, that's just using the language as it's intended. No, you can't really change the class dynamically as you're working with it. The way the class is defined is the way the object is defined, and that's the way the object is intended to work. If you want to expand the functionality of an object, you need to create a class with that expanded functionality. Any other questions? All right. Thanks, everybody, for coming, and good luck with your final projects. Right. And if you have any... thanks, Chris. If you have any questions for off the camera, I'll stick around for a little while, too, since that tends to be the case.